Good morning, Lynn. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Quite well.
Right.
So,
Happy New Year to
Happy New Year.
you. And you know
Yeah.
what? This since there have been some changes this year, and Lewis is no longer teaching with me. I don't know if you knew that. So
Oh, okay.
I'm going to be using these recordings and other teachings that I'm doing with some other folks, and using those for the House of the Rising Sun. So
Oh, great. Okay.
this will be the recording will be used for that, and we will continue with the tradition of having a House of the Rising Sun. We'll just have several different guests with me on it. So I think it's going to work well. So I got Teddy
Sounds great.
Poppy and Paul Gaudreau and a few other people I think are willing to teach with me, and so very cool. So how was your holiday?
Quiet and nice. Yeah, very pleasant, very peaceful. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah,
And
thank you.
yourself?
Yeah, very, very, very nice. It's been a lovely, lovely, lovely several days of just spending time with my family here, which I do all the time anyway. But my husband's been off work for a few days, or off and on. So it's always really pleasant to have him around the house. And so yeah, I'm enjoying myself completely. And I had a
Excellent.
wonderful Christmas. So
Well, good. Good. Likewise.
all right,
Likewise.
very good. Now,
Yeah.
is your wife, does she come out there to see you, or
Well, that's a long story.
okay. I don't want to hear.
But
Not long.
yeah. Well, basically I'm mostly here because my mother has some medical issues that she's working through and needs basically some significant help around the house for an extended period. So, here for the duration, not sure how long that'll be, basically. So,
Oh, well, we
yeah.
appreciate your we
Well,
appreciate your.
I'm actually happy to do it because it's a labor of love for multiple reasons, and we've actually always gotten along wonderfully because actually my mom is sort of my spiritual mentor in a lot of ways and has we often talk about metaphysical things, and that's really how I kind of got into that whole realm of inquiry. So I guess I'm really in that way fortunate. And yet at the same time, as I say that, I'm realizing, well, we all have an impetus. We all have, and anybody listening to this program right now probably wouldn't be listening to it unless they had some kind of recognition of a calling to n realize that there must be a better way. Otherwise, why would we be doing this? And I think that's why we're drawn to A Course in Miracles, we hear another voice that leads us to an alternative to the world's madness, and to see it gently as a mad idea, a tiny mad idea, and one we can not condemn, but just look at gently and with soft eyes and a gentle heart and a peacefulness that looks at the craziness of the world as just a coping strategy for a belief in the idea that somehow we've been able to pull off, and it's just a crazy idea because it didn't happen, a separation from perfect oneness or from God. We think that somehow we pulled it off, and so. What A Course in Miracles tells us, and I haven't found anything logically that would refute this, is that we do seem to have made up, not individually but collectively, an entire cosmos that is the sole purpose of which is to hide out as fugitives from a crime we never committed.
Exactly.
And because our minds are so powerful. And the Course is only about the mind, as Ken Wapnick reminds us. It's not about form, it's not about behavior, it's not about doing things in the world or fixing the world or changing the world or making the world a better place. Not that those aren't worthy things to do, but that's not what A Course in Miracles addresses.
Exactly.
and so, more power to you if you can, appear to pull those things off, but it's all dream repair, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we all can and probably should continue to do the things that we're capable of doing in the world to make it, a kinder, gentler, better place. But the place is in our mind, and that's where if we can remember that we don't have to repair our mind if we can find the part of it that never was damaged, which is really truly the totality of it. But that's not how we usually think, and so we need to have to start from where we think we're at, which is, as bodies with this, I guess I have this persona or mind, and because that's kind of how we think of ourselves most of the time, taking care of these vehicles of biological nature and doing all the things that we do to provide for their feeding and care and comfort and housing and medicine and entertainment and social needs and the whole gamut of stuff that we do in the world. If we can just kind of look at that with not a jaundiced eye, but just a whimsical eye,
right,
and see that it's all the same thing. And I think that's why I really appreciate more and more every year when I look at the Ken Wapnick's commentary about, making this year different by making it all the same, play on words there, that if we can learn to generalize, and maybe that's what we could talk about today, is learning to generalize the lessons is really the willingness to let go of our stubborn wanting to make exceptions and seeing where that's really costing us our peace. Because every time we make an exception to the forgiveness curriculum, we're basically saying, I'd rather be miserable just a little bit longer. It's just, it's a masochistic martyrdom approach.
I think it's more of a kind of a way of, I can do this on my own and I know how to do it. And and so I don't think that it's really being so much, well, it is, it's being willful and it's, But it's thinking that I can clean up the mess that I made, and it's because I believe that there's a mess here that needs to be cleaned up, and so we got to get back to that the very basic cosmology of the difference between the real world or heaven, which is not the real world, but let's just put that in one category, the difference between reality and what we're experiencing. And so as I'm experiencing a world that seems to be chaotic and unfriendly and painful and also beautiful and spiritual and inspiring, but I seem to be experiencing all these various experiences that would tell me that there's lots of things going on. And so the thing that you just quoted from chapter 15, Christmas as the End of Sacrifice, where he says, make this year different by making it all the same, is really about, in my opinion anyway, about leveling the version of reality that we're experiencing into recognizing that none of it is real, no matter how compelling it seems to be and how inviting or how terrifying it seems to be. None of it is real. And so if I can just look at it and recognize that it all has the same quality, there's one quality that all of it has, and that is not real.
yeah, very well stated. Very well stated. Yeah, that's it. It's that quality that if we can see it as a dream, as a movie, as a metaphor, as the characters that seem to populate our world are symbols, including the symbol that appears to have a reflection in the mirror when we walk up to one, and has all these identifications that we have first, middle, and last names, and social security numbers
Birth
and
certificates and
birth, yeah, all that
driver's
stuff.
licenses and
Yeah,
things
which I,
approve. It proves that
oh,
I'm here.
exactly. I can pull out all these cards and point to all these things on a little flat object that has, you know, pixels on it that says, oh, here's my name on it, or you know, here's something that indicates that there has been a person that it seems to be separate from other persons, that has these histories and that are very specific, and they're all tied together and interrelated with other, you know, seeming individuals with their histories, and but it's all a hoax.
It's all a hoax. It's all a hoax. And so that's the, to me, that is the sameness about all of it that I can look at no matter what appears to be happening. And it's not denial. It's not saying,
Right,
I
right.
know it's not real, so I'm not going to, worry about it. It's actually looking at it and recognizing the unreality of it. And when you see how you just ask yourself, how could this I've ever imagined that this was possible? And first off, if I look, whatever I look at, it's not just accompanied by a story in my mind. It is created, the fabric of it is created by the story in my mind. And so this is
Right.
why when you're looking for this through this filter of the personal mind, you're seeing only the very one tiny, tiny slice of what appears to be through this personal mind filter that is saying this is what is. So, this computer thing is black and this microphone is silver and there's a screen in front of me that's showing me these words, and there's this fellow who's writing things, Neil, who's writing things on the board that seems real. This is only my viewpoint. This is only my
Not to worry,
point of
Neil,
view.
that we're not saying you don't exist. We're just saying that we none of us do.
It's not your point of
We're all in the same boat here.
view. But so that's what's happening here is
Yeah,
if I
yeah.
see that everything, the only thing I know about any of this is what is being shown to me in this mind, which we've already established, is so limited in its ability to know or sense. I mean, we can barely, we're basically deaf, dumb, and blind here. And even though we seem to think we see so much, we really don't see hardly any bit what is
Right.
really here. If you could actually see what was really here, as far as even this reality we're projecting, if I could even just see the quantum elements that are making up all these things and the energies that are making it all be and work, and if I could actually see all these things, I it would be wondrously amusing, I'm sure, but it would also be very telling in that, what I've been seeing thus far is so limited. But not to get carried away on that whole thing, because you could go on forever with that. But then how does this
Right.
practically work in my life? And how does it practically work in my life? Neil is asking questions about purpose. And because we were talking about, purpose is meaning, chatting a little bit about that. And so here's the question here. If none of this is real, then and all of it is a projection of my mind, then what is my purpose even in talking to you right now? What is my purpose of sitting here in this room and having a conversation with, something that's also being projected and that I know is real? What would be the only, I mean, there you might think of many reasons, and it could be because, it's entertaining and I like to watch and I'm interested in seeing how great my mind is or whatever. If the purpose is not to remember God, then all of that is just wasted effort.
Right. And that thank you, Neil, for asking it, because that's such an important question and really a pivotal, crucial question for everything that we do. Not just the big picture question, but every little thing that we do. And if we can look at what motivates us, what's the purpose, the why, the big why, as well as all the little whys that we do everything that we do or seem to do everything that we do, that is hugely helpful, because that basically helps us get back to the mind, helps us look at the fact that en masse we have chosen a thought system that out of the chute anyway, the default mode, the little checkbox that's checked when we get here, is see this as, this is what's in it for me. The WIFM, that was the acronym that we used in the, when I was doing consulting for the Air Force a few years back, and helping people realize that no matter what industry or you know, segment of the society you're in, it can be beneficial to see shared interests and how to work together to solve common problems. Well, obviously there's other issues going on there, but in any situation, if we can look at the why, and gently return to our minds and see that the why of the ego is always to separate, to be divisive, to come up with some yet another reason that is never truly justified, but the ego likes to make it seem so, that we can either be in some way or another either a victim or a victimizer, and either one of those basically reinforces the guilt that is also unfounded. But the purpose of it is to say, I'm a separate thing. I'm here. I exist. I exist apart from God. And I think it's sometimes the special hate stuff, which is all the stuff that we love to hate, can be easier in some ways to look at and to get back from what the Course calls the wrong mind and the right mind. And it's not a judgmental or any kind of way, a moralistic kind of a thing. It's really more in terms of what's effective, what works and what doesn't work. And I like to think of it more in those terms, you know, Shakespeare said, nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And the Course actually talks about a couple different levels. One of the audios I was listening to from Ken Wapnick a week or two ago that really clicked for me was how that there's really, you know, these two levels in the Course. And the level one is where we're not even really aware of that for the most part. That's if you've ever seen Ken's famous chart, there's a line at the top, and on above that line, there's truth, God, oneness, you know, perfection, love, all that kind of stuff that are at this point where we think we're at most of the time, just nice ideas, you know, wouldn't it be nice kind of stuff. That's a reality. That's the truth of what we are. But that's not our experience most of the time. So what we have to deal with is the level two stuff for the most of our, you know, everyday lives. And that's where the real hope lies, is it's not in choosing to deny our experience here. In fact, early on in the Course it says to deny your physical experience is a particularly unworthy form of denial. Because what we're doing is we're denying the classroom. So anytime that we feel the least little bit of irritation or at least a little bit of annoyance, or of course, massive irritation or annoyance too, or anywhere in between, we can pretty much bet, you know, that, okay, we haven't unchecked that checkbox. We're still going in ego's default mode of seeing everything as a means for reinforcing a self that whose basic premise is victimization and, you know, somebody done something wrong, you know, and it wasn't me. And so whenever we can catch that, whether it's a spouse or a family member or a coworker or somebody on TV, it could be a pundit, it could be a political figure, it could be a religious figure, it could be somebody, a sports figure, somebody in the news, it could be somebody, you know, in the grocery store, it could, you know, a clerk in a place that we do business, or somebody that we chat with online, or it could be, you know, anybody, doesn't matter. But the purpose that we have to our thoughts is everything. So that, again, thanks, Neil. That's such an important question. And we can use then the purpose then can shift. That's the beauty of it. We can change. We can see a real alternative by shifting our purpose for everything from being another brick in ego's prison wall mentally, of, you know, cementing in the idea that we're stuck here, to taking the same thoughts, the same bricks, and dismantling ego's prison and building a classroom instead. And the bricks become transparent instead of opaque, you know, brick by brick, as we build that classroom metaphorically. And obviously there's nothing physical involved, but it's because the universe is mental. But for that metaphor to work, you know, it's basically each time we forgive ourselves for investing something in the world with the idea that this has power over me, and change that idea to one of, no, I've given everything I see in this room, on the street, from this window, in this place, all the meaning it has for me, for example. I love workbook lesson number two. I think that's, you know, it's so timely for people who are doing it on a calendar basis. It's such a wonderful metaphor for the fact that the meaning is the purpose, that the why. That's the why we're doing it. And if we can call that into question, which of course makes the ego incredibly uncomfortable. but we don't have to do it all at once. We can just, you know, find out where our comfort zones are and just look at the little things and kind of build up our spiritual muscle, so to speak, or mental or, you know, habitual practice expertise with. And it doesn't have to be ritualistic, but just to consistently generalize and to notice more and more every time that we're the least little bit upset about something. That's our classroom, and that becomes the new purpose. That's the new why. That's the new meaning that we give to things. Is I can now say, I see an object, you know, like all these early workbook lessons suggest. Is I see a cell phone or the cord of a headset or a pen resting between the pages of a book that has lesson 11 and lesson 12 on the facing pages, or a glass or a lamp, or a stack of unanswered correspondence and bills, or, you know, whatever it happens to be as you glance around the room, a stapler. Yeah, I'm picking something. a glass of water. But all those things have the meaning that we've given it because it's purposive. We gave those the function that they have for us out of incredible fluency in a script that we all collectively made up, and we all kind of on some unconscious level said, okay, Lynn, you take that part, and we'll call you Lynn, and I'll be Bruce, and I'll take this part, and Neil can take his part, and everyone else can take their part, but it's all purposive, and out of the chute by default, that purpose is to go for the terrible twos. Speaking of duality, and lesson number two is, the what's in it for me. Everybody for themselves mindset, which is, you know, give me back my toy. It's mine. And we want to divide and conquer the universe one toy at a time. And that it's just silly, isn't it? I mean, when we look at the why we do things, instead of what if I use this to get back to my mind? What if I shifted everything around? And that's a really radical idea. Is if we could discipline our minds and be vigilant enough to look at everything, and forgive ourselves when we're not, of course, because that's 99% of the effort right there. I think is, you know, when you catch yourself, especially doing the workbook in a yearly basis, and you catch yourself, oh wow, it's been 5 minutes or 5 seconds or 5 hours, and I haven't thought about my workbook lesson the entire day, for whatever. You can say, oh well, that's purposive. And so there again, there's that. They're a very important word, purpose. If we can look at the why we have so much resistance to this material, and like Ken says, if we're honest with ourselves as egos, we hate the course.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's obviously the part of us that's drawn to us loves it, and that's why we're here. But that's not really what we need to address, because if that was our only identity, if that was the only aspect of our awareness, you know, we wouldn't need it. We wouldn't be drawn to this, because we'd be done. We would have finished the curriculum before we started. However, because our minds are so powerful, and we've invested in this incredibly elaborate dream that portrays us all as having these separate little battles and issues and stories, we need to somehow find a way to turn that around. And that's, again, through the purpose. So thank you again, Neil, for that that wonderful word, because the purpose is everything, and the purpose of forgiveness is to return us from what the Course calls the wrong mind to the right mind, which is the maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem to the adaptive solution, which sees the problem as one in which we hand it over to what we really are, which the Course refers to as the Holy Spirit, and Jesus, you know, speaks in that voice as something that we can identify with, because we think we're so geared toward having external personas and teachers and symbols, but then what that teacher, which is just a symbolic aspect of our thinking, the same thinking that the Course represents, suggests is that we're all symbols too. We've got it all backwards, and yeah. That if we can see the characters in our lives as actors and on our payroll, we hired them. They're in the bottom line of every page of the script is our signature, you know, in the screenplay. It's like, what? I signed this? When did I do that?
Exactly. Well, and so there's a couple of different things that can be done here within this illusion. And Neil is asking, first he says, there's a lot of stuff he's asking about, but he says, those who I think of as most needful of the Course would have an incredibly strong resistance to it, I feel certain. And so this question, so he's saying that if the people who really need the Course would be really resistant to it. And here's the thing about all of this is that I'm the only one who really needs a Course. And I'm the only one who really needs to do the workbook. I'm the only one who really needs to accomplish accepting the atonement. I'm the only one who really needs to do those things. And if I think there's someone else out there who needs it, that's me too. That's all in my...
Right.
This is my whole... the way I see the world, the way I see my brother, the way I see myself, it's all coming from my own mind. In reality, no one needs a Course. In reality, everyone is perfect. In reality, we have never left heaven. So the only thing that needs to be switched is this part of my mind that thinks that it did leave heaven, that thinks that it is out here on its own, that thinks that it is, you know, fighting for its life. And the thing that's so ironic is the way that the Course is written, it is meant to capture the imagination of that one. It's meant to capture the imagination of that one and to give that one the idea that I can become enlightened. I can become awakened. And when I become awakened and enlightened, then I will see something that's not being seen by everyone else around me. And so the ego wants nothing more than to achieve that status. The ego is very excited about becoming enlightened, and that's
why spiritual specialness.
Spiritual specialness. So everyone all around is you know, when I awaken and I'm enlightened, then you know people will come to me, or people will listen to me, and people, you know, so and I will know God, and I will know what heaven is, and I will see the truth. That I that's saying all those things is not who I really am. That I who's saying all those things doesn't have a clue as what I really am, because what I really am already has all that stuff, already does all that stuff, already knows all that stuff. The only one who doesn't know all that stuff is ego. And so it's kind of it's a tricky thing. And I know that there's a lot of psychology. The course is written by a psychologist for the very purpose, because it's addressing the mind. And so that whole idea of kind of tricking the mind, and Jesus talks about, I think it's either in chapter 4 or chapter 8, where he talks to us about how we can, by doing this, can make our ego more of a servant rather than a master to us, and that the ego then will help us, which it does. It helps us all the time in this awakening process. It just, you know, it thinks that it can do it without accepting the atonement, without accepting the correction, which would make it no longer exist. It thinks somehow that there's an exception clause written into this. So, and that's okay, because you know, as long as I keep acting on that, I'm still going to be doing the lesson every day. I'm still going to be practicing forgiveness all the time. I'm still going to be trying to win the game. Mm-hmm. And as long as I'm trying to win the game, you know, I'm still working for that same purpose. You know, my methods may be less than perfect, but it's still working a number on softening up the ego and you know, getting me to know that that's not what I am. So it still doesn't work. I mean, it works with or without my permission. With or without the ego's permission. That's why he says in the introduction to the lessons, you don't have to believe this. You don't have to accept it. You know, all you have to do is just do it.
Right, right. And with that, the whole purpose, again, being to shift our awareness or our identity from the separate seeming selves that we have identified with to the real identity that we all share. Which is why it's not the Bruce or the Lynn or the Neil that's doing it. It's the decision-making mind that's behind those personas, that's beyond those seeming identities, that is being talked to and being awoken. That's what I mean. Again, ironically, you know, that's the part of us that's already been awake. That's what. Workbook lesson 192, you know, symbolizes as the little child, the little Christ child, basically, that beseeches imploringly, you know, without stop, that we just take a moment to get off the ego's treadmill. And yeah, we can use the ego. In fact, we must use every thought that the ego has as a way to take its prison and turned it into the Holy Spirit's classroom by forgiving ourselves for believing that you know, our identity could be anything less than perfect oneness. And the way that we do that practically in the world is by taking each thought that comes along during the day and asking ourselves mindfully, is this the identity I want? Is this
yes
what I want to be? And then the ego, of course, always speaks first and says, of course it is. This, you know, this is what we are, you know, this is what I am. And how dare you ask, you know, and early you know, we say that it's not about, you know, teaching anyone else. I was thinking to the ego, that them's fighting words, you know, that's that's because we think that as long as there's somebody out there that needs to change, whether it's, you know, no matter what the change appears to be, then we're saying that I've got my dream repair technician hat back on again, and I've got to go out there and, you know, do the good fight and you know, fix the dream. And there's other people and other things responsible. You know, it doesn't have to be a person or a group of people. It can be like, you know, the atmosphere or the global environmental situation, or it could be, you know, photons, you know, streaming from the sun. It could be, or not, you know, or yeah. It could be any range of things that we ascribe our peace of mind to, instead of saying to ourselves, oh, no matter what seems to happen on this incredibly convincing holographic, you know, fantasy dream screen that is so convincing, and it would be silly to not, you know, take it as something that we need to deal with. But it's a dream. It's a massive holographic, you know, three-dimensional video, like Ken says, you know, the DVD. But we can choose which track, which director's cut. We can at any given moment we can choose the ego's director's cut in the special features, or we can just turn the volume off on that and just watch it without condemnation. Watch it without the the 2-year-old blather, since we're on lesson two today, the blather that continues to say, this is happening to me. There's the two again. but it's always and ever just an exercise in returning ourselves to our mind gently without condemnation and realizing that everybody's in the same boat and we can afford to gently laugh at how silly that is by forgiving ourselves moment to moment, huh?
Exactly. It seems so convoluted. And I know that a few years ago when I first started and was, trying to figure this out, and it just seemed convoluted and it seems so hard. It seems so very hard. And yet I look at my life today and look at how, quickly I come to forgiveness when I have an upset or I think that something has gone wrong, how quickly I turn to the Holy Spirit and ask for a different way of seeing what is happening, how quickly I decide that I want to choose again. And how satisfying it is when that happens, because it takes away all the fear, all the upset, all the anger, all the any feeling that I'm feeling less than peaceful. It takes that away. And what's so cool about it is that I can notice now anytime things come up, and I can. It's like it doesn't take long for me to do that switch, to do that turnaround. Now, there are times, and the other thing that's so amazing about it is that when I'm deciding not to, I know it too. I see it, and I know I'm doing it, and I'm doing it purposely. And I used to be just so, what's wrong with me? I must be just crazy. Why do I keep doing this to myself? Why do I want to be so mad? I used to be like that to myself, that I was, really, something was wrong with me. And I realize now it has nothing to do with me at all. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with me. When those things come up and I am reluctant to forgive, and those kind of things, cause I'm sure you have them yourself.
Absolutely.
I do not want, I just want to be mad. I think there's a song, like a country song.
I want to be mad. No, not that one.
Yes. I want to be mad for a while or something, but it's true. I just want to be mad for a while sometimes, and I recognize it and I know it, and I just laugh at it. I just smile at it. I just look at it and say, mm-hmm. Oh, you little child.
Yeah. And Ken Wapnick points out, he says, nowhere in the course does Jesus refer to us as adults, And I say the word Jesus, only in the sense that that's how the course uses that language. And I'm still working on that language. I had, a traditional, Protestant upbringing, in a lot of ways. So it took me a while, it took me up until about 3 years ago, even though I bought the book in the mid 80s when I first got into the course. I bought Jesus and Forgiveness. And I think it was because of what it represented, the painting on the cover of the book, and the fact that here was all this religious baggage that I was working through, and I think it relates directly to what you're just saying, Lynn, is that I think because of our Judeo-Christian ethic, and this is not certainly limited to any religion or any culture, but I think that it reflects and fulfills the role that ego would have it do, of basically reinforcing the unconscious guilt, because we think, I must be horrible because I'm still choosing against this gentle inner counsel, and and really 99% of the curriculum really can be, I think, considered to be forgiving yourself for probably 100%, but forgiving yourself for those lapses in diligence and those lapses in mindfulness and the willfulness and the wanting to be off on our own, to be the terrible two, the horrible duality of I'm doing it on my own. I'm John Wayne here. I can do it myself, and is there anything wrong with that dream? No, but it's a dream. It's a silly, forgivable dream. And that's where I think that perspective, and another phrase that Ken says, you can't get too far from the metaphysics of the Course. Because if we can remember that what we're experiencing is a projection of the mind, and ideas never leave their source, and it still exists in mind, and that what we think of as solid, tangible objects, and modern physics corroborates this, is no, it's just probability clouds of ideas, basically. It's not how most physicists would refer to that, but that's where that's leading. If you ask any physicist about the nature of what we call reality, they would say, well, it's a probabilistic thing even where an electron is at any given moment. If you pin it down, then you don't know other things about it. So as long as you know one thing, you can't know other things. And that's what quantum mechanics has basically proven within the realm of that dream, which is to say that the ego's view of the cosmos is always going to be incomplete because it's always based on a lie. So you can't pin anything down in a dream because there's nothing to pin down. There's nothing there. And the beauty is that what we really are is everything. But the ego would have us believe that if we get rid of the nothingness, if we do the denial ego style, then what was left is oblivion. Well, no, the ego is already oblivion and suffering and a no fun existence. but it really objects strenuously when it's pointed. That's when we choose a thought system that points that out. So that's why there's not a lot of people drawn to the Course, because there's I have a number of friends that and colleagues and family members and that seem to have a pretty good life. Why would I want to look at this stuff that asked me to look at my mind? It's like, I don't want to go there. I mean, I might have to, but again, like you say, and I really appreciate your response to Neil's most recent question that you talked about, is that it's not about anybody else. It's always back to what's going on in my mind, because that's the only tag I'm it. The only person that the Course, and each one of us, seeming separate selves, can say this, because each of us truly is the decision-making mind that's believing that there's separate individuals. And we've conveniently labeled that an aspect of, this all-inclusive, indivisible, all-encompassing, unseparatable self. But because we're so entrenched in that, that's where we need to work from. And to get back to that, we just need to forgive ourselves for having invested in all the specifics, and when forgive the specifics in our mind one idea at a time. And it's that self-study program that the Course represents. We can look at each seeming separate person, thing, on the street, from this window, in this place, in this room, and realize we've given it all the meaning that it has for us. We gave it and invested it with properties that aren't anything but fantasies. It's we're having a mass hallucination by thinking that there's something specific that is impinging on us, that's outside of ourselves, and that there could. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing.
And what's amazing to me is if you do these lessons, because I remember it's been about 3 years ago or so, and I actually was in this very room that I'm in right now when I was doing lesson two, mm-hmm. and it really, I really began to see exactly what he meant by, I've given everything the meaning that it has for me. And as I looked around the room and I saw things like books on the shelves and a little, one thing that really hit me was my husband has a little carved wooden thing of his name, just Rick, that this fellow made for him, that where he worked. He used to work at Storage Tech. He worked there for, you know, many years. And this guy made him this, you know, name thing for his desk. And he brought it home and he was so, you know, look at how beautiful this thing is. And the next day the guy had a heart attack and died.
Oh, gosh.
And so when I looked, when I was sitting here in this room, looking around, and I looked at that and I thought, you know, I had never realized the meaning that I gave to this thing, and how much went into my thinking about this thing. And then I started looking at everything, and it didn't matter what it was. It could be this hand lotion, or, you know, I especially was looking at, you know, my chair and my desk and my computer, and realizing the meaning that I have put into all of these things that were things that I actually made to take the place of the comforts and the joys and the communication and everything that is real, that would be what would be happening in heaven. 'Cause, you know, in heaven, I would have no butt, so I would need no chair. So there wouldn't be a whole lot of chair manufacturers out of business, a lot of miners out of business mining ore for the metal, a lot of oil companies out of business for the stuff that goes into making the plastic and all that kind of, you know. I think about, you know, if this one problem were solved, as the problem of me believing that I need a chair, it would completely change the entire surface of the earth and what's done with that. If you were looking at in terms of the world, how everything would change if you didn't think you were a body and you needed clothes and you needed food and you needed a chair and you needed a computer to talk to your brother who is right here with me, has never left me, and yet I think you're in California. And so not only do I need a computer, I need a generator to generate electricity. So I need people out there mining coal so I can talk to Bruce. I need
or installing solar panels.
Or selling solar panels so I can talk to Bruce. I need.
But it's all part of the dream, isn't it? Yeah.
There's no better.
From one dream scenario to another.
Yeah. So you know, I need a satellite. I need space travel. I need to be able to, you know, get out of this earth so that I can send a signal so I can talk to Bruce. You know, all of these things are being made as concessions to our handicap.
It's all an adjustment,
I mean,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's an adjustment, yeah.
The maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem, as Ken said so eloquently. Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? But we can look, we can turn all those things around, and use the purpose. So again, thanks Neil for that question about purpose, because that we can, the purpose for everything can then become, you can take that your husband's name plaque and say, oh, I can see this as a way that I, just like everybody else, make special things and special stories about special people and special events and you know, jobs and situations. As you were sharing that a moment ago, I was thinking of about 12 years ago now, I was actually giving a sacred geometry keynote speech in a conference. It was actually plenary, you know, meetings that were had just several hundred people about sacred geometry in Sedona, Arizona. And I got to know several people there, and a couple of them invited me to stop by on my way back, and I hung out with them for part of a day in Las Vegas, and then they came to visit when I lived in Northern California, not too far east of here. You know, within that same year, I think it was. So I was kind of showing them around Nevada County, you know, east of Sacramento, and places where I'd lived for about two decades, and at the time. And And as I was doing that, the investment I had in those stories, I realized, why is this such a big deal? You know, I was telling them things I'd done there, or people that I knew there, or as we were driving around the area, and I was kind of showing them around, or, you know, I'm trying to, you know, emphasize the things that they'd be interested in. But I was watching my mind and noticing all the lather of all of my personal stuff. You know, it's like my associations with all these things.
It made you real.
Oh, well, not only that, but it was like, why would anyone care about this? Why do it? But it was a nice way to, in a very gentle, easy way, because they were very polite, and you know, they you know, kind of nodded politely as I was talking about all the stuff that you know, a lot, even the things that I was trying to make it something that they would be interested in, were probably like, yeah, sure, right, whatever you say, Bruce, kind of thing. And I mean, we had time and everything, but it was just interesting to watch that process of making a big deal out of specifics, and that's the mechanism that we use to generalize the lessons of the course, is to look around at all the stories of the things that are familiar and unfamiliar, the things, the places we've been and we haven't been, the people that we quote know and quote don't know, you know, and all of our associations and beliefs around, and you know, positive and negative feelings about it. It's like, nothing's happening there, you know. Hey, do we have time to read a very short FAQ?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay. I thought it'd be good to read. I'm just at least one. I like to touch base with these because I think they're so potent, full of good stuff. So I'll read number 1012 in the frequently asked questions of facimoutreach.org. And it's only got two short paragraphs. It says, the question is, in 1985, extraordinary experience of oneness with God. I have never considered myself a religious person and never understood why people were religious. I came away from this experience believing to my very core in things that I didn't really understand, i.e. there is no sin, God is mind, do not judge, we are all one, etc. The experience was one of profound remembering where I belonged, and it surely wasn't here on earth. My path since then has been convoluted. After attempting to adapt my personal, quote, knowledge, unquote, to other religions, I read and attempted to practice A Course in Miracles, but soon gave it up to turn to other things. Sound familiar? I certainly had a few years where I was...
I never did that.
...put on the back burner, but then that's the whole point of the workbook, isn't it? To forgive yourself when you put it on the back burner and when you choose against that piece. I have recently had a renewed interest in the course, but have many questions about my own personal experience and no one to talk to about it. Is this type of experience a common occurrence? And then the answer in two short paragraphs is, there's no way of knowing how many people have had such an experience. Not more than a few have mentioned something like this to us. There certainly could be many others who have experienced their oneness with God and now live quietly in peace and love, being the sole source of their thoughts and activities. They would not have a need to talk about their lives, although they could be, speaking of talking about your lives, although they could be guided by love to do so. Jesus talks about the experience of union with God in the section in the manual called Can God Be Reached Directly? And that's section 26 in the manual for teachers. You might find it helpful to read that, and also the earlier one entitled How Should a Teacher of God Spend His Day? And that's section 16 in the manual.
And by the way, that Can God Be Reached Directly? That mm-hmm. has some astonishing things in that section.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Astonishing things about who we are and what we are and what we can and cannot do. It's pretty amazing. Anyway, so go on.
Well, maybe we could do a session on that, too.
I would love to do that, yes.
Sure. Okay. And then the concluding paragraph is, the focus of A Course in Miracles is on forgiveness, not God, even though he is mentioned on just about every page. The course is about our daily practice of its lessons, rather than on experiencing oneness with God. It is nice when one has such an experience, as that provides a glimpse of the end of the process. But reflecting that oneness, reflecting that oneness in the relationships of our lives is the immediate objective of the course's teachings. We do that by first recognizing our wrong-minded dedication to seeing our interests as separate from others, and then asking for help to shift that perception to shared interests, where we realize that we are all, without exception, joined both in the pain of separation from God and in our common call for help to awaken from that nightmare. Then, when, quote, not one illusion is accorded faith, and not one spot of darkness still remains to hide the face of Christ, unquote, minds will rest in the peace and stillness of perfect oneness. So I thought that was appropriate.
That is beautiful. And it is appropriate because I don't know, I've had this kind of experience myself. And, you know, I know a lot of people who've had that kind of experience. And what has happened, and for the most part, this has been my experience, is that I denied my experience because I thought that it was imaginary, or I thought that, well, ego, this is how, you know, when you do have any kind of a revelatory experience, the ego is all over that. 'Cause that's about the end of me. And, you know, I even noticed, you know, when I was a little kid and I had my folks always said I had a, overactive imagination. And,
how do they know? But they were talking about all of us.
All of us, yeah. But I had an overactive imagination, and I also because I used to see things, and when I was in you know, whatever you think about this, and you know, you can think whatever. I was a kid when I was about like 5 or 6 years old. I don't even remember. Was in church, and you know, I was Catholic. Was in church and kneeling down and looking up at the crucifix, which hung up over the altar. And if you've been to Catholic churches in general, especially the old ones, you know, they have these gruesome crucifixes hanging up over the altar with Jesus all hanging there with his, you know, he's, you know, he's all, you know, bloody and beaten and, you know, and just, you know, looking pretty bad, pretty mournful.
A crucifix.
Yeah, a crucifix. Exactly. So now I'm sitting there looking up at that thing, and I swear to you, the head, the face on that crucifix turned and looked at me, and Jesus winked his eye at me. All right.
That's great.
Okay.
I love it.
All right.
Like, kind of stifling uncontrollable laughter, you know, like an old Carol Burnett show episode, or maybe Stephen Colbert trying to, you know, to keep himself from cracking up, you know, those kind of things. Because it's a joke. It's hilarious to think that we could suffer, you know, and like that wonderful soothing phrase, you know, how can you who are so holy suffer? You know, I've saved all of your kindnesses and every loving thought, and because that's what's real. And it's not this separate seeming experience that, well, I had this epiphany that could come and go, because no, that anything that is changeable isn't it. I mean, we've listened to the ego again. It's like, oh, it's this specific thing. No, it's not. but that we can just kind of wink gently and that inner smile that says, nothing happened here.
Nothing happened here.
Our real nature continues unabated, unscathed, in perfect innocence and perfect luminous joyous peace throughout eternity, but we're just dreaming that somehow we were able to, you know, escape from that and build something that we thought was going to be better. You know, I'll do it myself and I'll do one better for you, on you, God. Kind of, it's like, no, it didn't happen. But anyway.
Yeah. But and I believed that it didn't happen. That's the thing. When you question your experiences, and ego will make you question any experience that you have with any kind of connection with God, then you're going to say, well, it didn't really happen and it's not really real. And I went through my whole life thinking, you know, I just made that up. Although I can still see it, and it's very clear to me, and I, you know, thought that I had an active imagination, overactive imagination, that's for sure.
Didn't we all? We made up a whole universe as an unconscious, you know, to stay unconscious as a shield of oblivion, a whole realm of space and time, to hide from unconscious guilt, which is equally unreal and unfounded. And that inner shield is just as much of a joke. And But we need to use those two shields of oblivion in order to get beyond them. We because we think we're stuck on the other side of those shields, we need to use our reaction and interaction and relationship to those symbols in order to get beyond the symbols.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, the trick for me, or the lesson for me, is to not get so caught up in how much I still have to let go of and learn, and to just not get caught up in that, and just to know that that's not my problem. That's not my business. I don't, you know, all I know is where I'm at right now, and that I don't. Knowing that, you know, I believe what Jesus says, and I believe that it's Jesus saying it, that we're already home and we're just dreaming about this. You know, you said something earlier, and I'm just going to take an extra minute here. You said something earlier about ideas leave not their source, and that is absolutely true. The ideas of the ego do not leave their source, and they are completely unreal. Mm-hmm. And so when you start thinking that, you know, well, the ideas of the ego are real, then you can, there's something to be afraid of. Because if they don't leave their source and they're real, then I'm in big trouble. But their source is not real.
Right.
So the whole idea, the only ideas that are real are the thoughts of God. And so, you know, I don't have to give any kind of credence to those thoughts of ego, or believe them, or worry about them, or be afraid because they're coming from inside the house. I have to actually recognize that there is no house, and and it's all made up. So I'm not stuck forever in a fearful world of terror. I'm just visiting, and you know, I bought the ticket, and I'm riding the roller coaster for the 9 millionth time, and you know, I'm ready to get off and go home. So
be passersby, right?
Yeah, be passersby.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I always enjoy our conversations.
Oh, me too. I love it, and I will be sending you the recording of this, and I'll be playing it again later too for House of the Rising Sun.
And so I'll post it on ACIM blog.
All right, thank you so much for doing that too.
Thank you.
And you know, we're getting out there, and we're getting more. And I'm working on the schedule of Awakening Together, and trying to make it more interactive. Put some links in there so people can see what's going on, and so. That's going to be cool, and, you know, just trying to make things better. So, thank you again so much, Bruce. And right now I'm going to be doing a meditation. So we're doing meditations twice a day now. So I'm going to be hosting a Sufi meditation after us on the mornings. So, that's what we will go from now to the Sufi meditation. And, Bruce, I love you.
Likewise.
I so enjoy your company. And thank you so much. And we'll talk to you next week.
Looking forward to it.
All righty. Bye-bye. Thanks again.
Bye.